Parshas Mishpatim. We're going to start discussing this parsha by asking some questions. And we will hopefully complete the class with the answers. The questions that we'll be asking pertain to some basic laws and narratives that we find in this week's parsha. And also to some famous midrashim that we are familiar with, but we never perhaps analyze deeply. So here are some of the questions. Number one, our first question and probably our last answer. In the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim, which are the laws, the civil laws, the laws between man and his friend, his neighbor, you might say, begins with the laws of a slave, when the laws pertaining to a Jewish slave. And among these laws we find that if a slave does not want to take advantage of the option to go free after 7 years of working at the Shemitah year, he has the option to express his desire to stay with his master. And he's permitted to stay with his master. However, there's a ceremony that must be done before he's allowed to remain with his master. And that ceremony is that he is taken to the Sanhedrin, the Beis Din, and they bring him up close next to the opening of the door, the doorpost, and they pierce his ear as a symbol that he has done something wrong, that it is not admirable that he wants to stay with his master, although it is permissible. So Rashi tells us, and we are now in chapter 21, Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Vav, which is 6. V'gisho Adonav El Elohim, which is the Beis Din, V'gisho El Hadeles, O El HaMezuzah, he comes to the door or the doorpost, V'ratza Adonav Es Azno, he pierces his ear, B'martzeo, with an awl, V'avado La'olam, and then he becomes his servant forever, and La'olam here means till Yovel, not eternally, but until the Jubilee year. Now Rashi says here, brings down from the oral law that the reason his ear is pierced is for two reasons. If he became a slave because he stole and he could not afford to pay back, so we pierce his ear to indicate that you who heard at Har Sinai, this ear that heard at Har Sinai, lo tignov, you shall not steal, went ahead and stole, so now we pierce your ear. Or if the person is a slave because he was destitute and he could not support himself, so he sold himself into slavery, we pierce his ear also, and we say, you who heard at Har Sinai, li avada avadim, that they should be slaves to me, the Jewish people, and not slaves to other slaves, not slaves to a human master, which is a slave to Hashem. Then, because this person has heard this at Har Sinai, this ear has heard, li avadim, they should be slaves to me, and he prefers to be a slave to another human being, a slave to a slave, so his ear is pierced. Now, this is very nice, sounds very poetic. However, there's some basic questions. Number one, why pierce his ear now for the crime of not paying attention to lo tignov, do not steal, or do not have other masters, when this happened up to 7 years ago? Pierce his ear at the time that he stole and based and sold him. Pierce his ear at the time that he sold himself. Basic, simple question, why now? Why now when he expresses the desire to stay with his master? And secondly, whoever learns Chumash and Rashi knows that the lo tignov, do not steal, in the Aseres Hadibros that we just learned does not refer to stealing money at all. It refers to kidnapping. It refers to stealing a human soul. And so this person is not guilty of that crime at all. And so why are we blaming him for not hearing properly the commandment of lo tignov? He stole money. What does one have to do with the other? This is the first question that we'll start with. Then we'll ask another question. The question is on that famous Midrash about Hashem going to the nation of Yishmael and the nation of Esav prior to perhaps the giving of the Torah to the Jews and offering them the Torah. And we know their response is, what's in it? And Hashem answers, well, don't kill, don't steal. And the nations answer, no, that's not for us. We live like that. It's impossible. We don't accept the Torah. So Hashem went and brought it to the Jewish people, and the Jewish people accepted the Torah. Now, a basic question on this Midrash. If the children of Yishmael or the children of Esav rejected the receiving the Torah on the basis of commandments that they prefer not to keep, like not killing and not stealing, is it not the case that they are anyway bound by those laws under the framework of the seven mitzvos that all B'nai Noach, all Gentiles are bound by? What exactly did they excuse themselves from here when they rejected the laws of not killing and not stealing? What is the Medrash telling us? They were bound by those laws anyway, and in addition, the Jews who did receive the Torah were bound by most of the same laws anyway, well before the Torah was given. Shabbos had been given, belief in only one Hashem, not serving idols, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, don't bear false witness. This has all already been established years, generations before the Jewish people accepted these laws at Sinai. So what is at the core of that medrash? That's our second question. Third question, about the end of Parshas Mishpatim. Chapter 24 seems to be a narrative of a celebration that took place at Har Sinai. But it's very unlike the story of the experience of Har Sinai that we saw in Parshas Yisro in 19. So our first question is, when did the events in chapter 24 take place? A brief synopsis is Moshe is called up into the top of the mountain, and the nation says here, Naseh, and then it's in Pasuk Gimel, and then they say in Pasuk Zayin, Naseh v'nishma. Three times do we see that phrase. Once back in Yisro, when Hashem offered them to be a Gai Kadosh, a holy nation and a kingdom of priests, a general offer to have an elevated status, they said, Naseh, we will do it. Then here in Mishpatim, in the third Pasuk, Moshe told the people, as Divrei Hashem, what are these words of Hashem that the Torah doesn't tell us specifically? And the people say, Naseh, we will do it. And then we see in Pasuk Zayin, Moshe writes all of the words of Hashem, which we need to know what they are, in a sefer, and he builds a mizbeach, and he makes 12 pillars, one for each shevet, and they offer karbanos, they offer olot and zevachim, two types of offerings. Moshe reads the sefer habrit that he had just written of the divrei Hashem. We're not sure yet what's in this sefer habrit, the book of the covenant. He reads it to them. And then they say, Naseh v'nishma. This is the famous Naseh v'nishma. Takes place in Mishpatim, five chapters after the story in Yisro of the giving of the Torah. And then Moshe takes the blood of these animals that he slaughtered, which half was sprinkled on the Mizbeach. And after the Jewish people say, Naseh v'nishma, we will do it and we will listen, he sprinkles it on the people. And then the people sit down, it seems, to eat and to drink and to glance, to gaze at Hashem. And they see some image of God, which we don't quite understand. It's a sapphire brick or whatever. We'll discuss it. This is the story of Perek Chaf Dalet 24. So our question here is, when did this happen? It sounds like a completely different story than what we heard in Parshas Yisro. In Parshas Yisro, if you think about the giving of the Torah there, it's complete with thunder and lightning and terrifying silence. The people were shuddering in their camp. Moshe had to bring them out to stand before Hashem. Hashem spoke to them, and as we know the Medrash, they passed out, they died, they had to be revived. They begged Moshe, please take over, we can't hear this straight from Hashem. The mountain, Rashi tells us back there, the mountain was above them like a barrel ready to drop on their heads. Remember, the pasuk says they stood around at the foot of the mountain, Batachtit Hahar, in the bottom of the mountain. Rashi says, Kafa aleim har kegigit, the mountain was hovering above them like a big barrel and said, if you don't accept the Torah, this is it. This is your burial place. It's a whole different story. How do we blend together the events in Parshas Yisro and the events in Parshas Mishpatim? And our last question. In Parshas Yisro, Hashem offered them to be a Gai Kadosh, Umamlechet Kohanim, a holy nation, and they said, everything that Hashem says, Naseh, we will do. We are ready to accept everything. Hashem tells them, get ready, prepare, they do, They're preparing themselves for Har Sinai. And then we have the story of this fearsome, as we just spoke about, thunder, lightning, and the mountain over their heads. Basic question, why? What is the need for Hashem to put the mountain over their heads and terrify them and threaten them after they've already come out with an open statement that whatever Hashem wants, we are prepared to do. Nasa, we are ready to do. And how is actually Nasa v'nishma greater than plain Nasa? We will do and we will hear. So these are some of the basic questions we need to answer to get a flow of what is happening in these stories, in these parshios. So firstly, let's find out how the story flows. When did the events of Parshas Perek Chaf Dalet take place? And here is a little point, a diktuk point, which is an interesting point to keep in mind as we learn Chumash. It comes up now and then. Rashi says that the events in Perek Chaf Dalet took place before Matan Torah. Rashi says on Pasuk Aleph, Parsha Zu Nemra, Kodem Aseret Hadibrot, before the giving of the Ten Commandments, on Dalid Sivan. We know the giving of the Ten Commandments was Hey, Vav, Sivan, Dalid Sivan. So this whole story takes place before the story in Parsha, in Perek 19. Now the question is, why is it here? Now there's a rule, Ein Mukdam Umuchar BaTorah. There is no natural, or there doesn't have to be, rather, a chronological order to the Torah. But that's not an answer to a question. That's a principle. The principle is that God's Torah is not bound by chronological sequence. But now the question is, why not? Why would they purposefully take something out of place and put it somewhere else? There has to be a rationale behind it. Question number one, how does Rashi know that this section is not in sequence? How does he know? This is a diktuk point. The first time Rashi points out in his whole commentary on Chumash that something is out of sequence is in Bereishis, Perek Dalet, Pasuk 1. There, after the story of the sin, of the Eitz Hadas, the sin of the tree, the first Pasuk of chapter 4 says, V'ha'adam yada es Chava. And Adam knew, was intimate with, Chava. Rashi says there, Va'adam yada, and the man knew her. Rashi says, Kvar kodem ha'inyan shel mala. This took place already before the previous story. And further on, he says, She'im katav vayeda Adam. If it had written vayeda and Adam knew her, putting the verb vayeda, what he did before him, his own name, before what the critical person that we're speaking about in the pasuk, we would have known it happened in place vayeda Adam. But the Torah switches the terminology, says vaha Adam yada. This is an indication always that it's out of place. There's another example in Perek Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. You know the famous story of when Hashem remembered Sarah to allow her to conceive, and it's written directly after she had been taken by Pasuk Chaf Aleph, right after she had been taken by Avimelech, and Avimelech didn't touch her, and then he begged Avram to heal him and all of his people because they were cursed with a special disease because he had taken Sarah. Then Pasuk Aleph says, "VaHashem pakad es Sarah." Rashi says it happened before she was released from Avimelech, but it's put in here because we want to teach a lesson that thematically is related, that whoever prays for his friend is answered first. So it's taken out of place. But had it said "VaYifkod Hashem et Sarah," we would have known it happened here because the terminology switch and it's "Hashem pakad es Sarah." We know what happened previously. So now look at our parak, Chaf Dalet. Ve'el Moshe Amar, Ale. And to Moshe, he said, come up on the mountain, as opposed to Vayomer El Moshe. It's El Moshe Amar. This is a standard rule. Whenever Rashi sees this, he will tell you it's out of place. Okay? So that's number one. Rashi understands it's out of place here. So now that we know what happened before the events of Sinai, let's try to reconstruct the whole story. And then we come to some philosophical questions based on that. It seems to be that on Dalet Sivan, the Jewish people said Naseh, firstly in Yisro. This is really interspersed in the middle of chapter 19. First, Hashem offers them, will you be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests, a general offer to raise their status. And they say, Naseh, whatever you say, we will do. Then Moshe comes and he writes to them. He comes down and tells them the Divrei Hashem, the words of Hashem. The words of Hashem, Rashi says here, are the instructions of preparation for the 3 days before Har Sinai, Shlosha Simei Hagbola. These are the Divrei Hashem. He tells them how to prepare, and they again say, Naseh, anything you want, we will do. Then Moshe writes Divrei Hashem, the words of Hashem, in a book. He builds a Mizbeach, 12 pillars, one for each nation. He sends them to offer olot uzvachim, different types of karbanos, and takes half of the blood and sprinkles it on the Mizbeach, and takes this book he wrote, which is now called Sefer HaBris. Rashi says, what is Sefer HaBris? Everything from Bereshis till Matan Torah. And he reads the Sefer HaBris to the people, and they say, Naseh v'nishma. And then he sprinkles the blood on them, now that they are bound by a bris with a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And this is when they glance some vision of Hashem. They eat and they drink. They offer karbanos. They celebrate. It's the next day with the thunder and the lightning and the terror and the mountain over their head and the absolute silence that then takes over that precedes Har Sinai. So now we have another question. Once they have willingly, happily, as we asked before, agreed to everything, offering karbanos and rejoicing and eating and celebrating, in other words, it seems what we're saying is they're receiving, accepting the Torah from a madrega of ahava, of great love and happiness to participate, to join in a bris with Hashem. Now, why does Hashem go and bring them to a state of fear and terror? Don't we always say that yira, fear, is a lower level than love? To compel someone means that they aren't yet ready to take it upon themselves on their own. So why does here the fear follow the love? And then we have some little questions. What are olos and what are zvachim? So as we go deeper, we have to analyze all these little points. So if this is the sequence of events, let's talk about, first of all, love and fear. Rambam says in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah that first comes love and then comes fear. It's clearly in our story there was love and there was fear. What is the relationship of one to the other? Why do we seem to see that fear is greater than love over here? What are olos and what are zvachim? What these two types of sacrifices? In ola is a sacrifice that reminds us of Yitzchak on the Akedah. That was the first Ola ever attempted to be brought. An Ola is a carbon that is completely burned up. Entirely burned up. The person doesn't take part of it at all. It indicates that the person, if they could, would be willing to sacrifice themselves totally to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that they see themselves as an extension of the will of Hashem, and if Hashem wants them to somehow give away their life, they are willing and they accept it. They are on the madrega where they can imagine total self-abnegation before God. And Ola represents total sacrifice, total surrender, which is certainly what we are called to do before Hashem. A zevach is a different type of a karbon. A zevach is a carbon that a person offers to God and they also partake of, they also eat from. There are three times up till now that we see the offering of a zevach. One is when Yaakov goes to Beersheba on his way to Mitzrayim to begin the gullus. And he knows he's beginning the gullus. And what's happening is that he is giving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he is affirming that he is a partner with Hashem. He will play his role. He will go into the gullus, whatever it will bring upon him, however long it will be, whatever tzaris will be involved, he is willing to play his role because his part is to go down, and his being there and his nation developing there and the servitude, everything ultimately is for the Gilui Shechina of the great Yetzias Mitzrayim, of Hashem's revelation, which will bring the knowledge of Hashem to the world. He's willing to play his role. The second time we see zevachim is Karban Pesach, and the third time is here, by Matan Torah. A zevach is a karban that the person partakes of. Think about the paganistic worldview. It would be inconceivable to imagine for a pagan that a human being would eat from the gift that he's offering God. It's the height of arrogance. It's a total rebellion against their God. The pagan view was that the gods controlled everything, and they whatever the whole pagan story there, where the human beings were basically pawns, vulnerable pawns, and the attempt of the human was to appease the God, keep them happy. Never would a human being eat from God's gift. But the Jewish people initiated this concept that there is a bris, there is a partnership between God and people, the Jewish people, and we play our role and Hashem plays his role, and we willingly accept our side of it, and we eat from the korban to God. So at Korban Pesach, where they're willing, beginning to be born as the nation with all of its responsibilities and obligations, they give a zevach, they offer a zevach. And here at Matan Torah, they are obviously, in Mishpatim, agreeing to their side of the bris happily with eating and drinking and offering the karbanos and one for each, one monument for each tribe. Every tribe individually and as a nation is joining in the bris. Well, what is a bris? Certainly the zevach is associated with the bris because it represents two sides of one coin, you might say. But what is a bris? Is a bris two people joining forces for one common good? In other words, you have goods to sell. I need to buy goods. Let's make a bris. Let's make a promise. I'll only buy your goods and you'll only sell to me. Is that a bris, according to Jewish philosophy? No. Because each person is in it only for themselves. A bris is not two becoming one. A bris, think about the covenant between the parts. Think about here the dam, half on the Mizbeach, half on the Jews. A bris is one entity split in two, both aspects representing the original truth. Hashem and the Jewish people are in a bris. There's one MS in the world. Hashem reveals it in his way, and the Jewish people reveal it in our way. But we're both revealing the same truth. We do it through physical action, through behavior, through mitzvos, through interactions with other people. Hashem does it through nisim, through running the world. But we're both expressing the same thing. That's called a bris. Both are on the same page. Both are geared to the same end point. There's no individual identity. We see how a zevach and a bris go together. The bris, this bris, comes before the mound, the thunder and the lightning and all of that. It seems to be the highest madriga that a human being can reach, to join in a bris with Hashem, to happily play our part, to release, surrender all our own agendas, to say we are here to express the Ritzon Hashem. Hashem does it his way, we can do it only through our way, we happily accept it. What can be greater? Why the fear now imposed afterwards? So here's an example. You have a woman, she's older, very well established, a wealthy woman. She has time on her hands and she's a good-hearted person. So she wants to do something meaningful. So she begins to volunteer in an old age home. And she goes every single day. And she bathes the old people and she feeds them. And it's not pleasant or appealing work, you might say. It's sometimes very unappealing. She washes them. She sits and talks to them. She spends her time there. She's there all the time. She barely takes a vacation. She's very dedicated. She's thoroughly, you know, she thinks what the people would need. She takes care of them. She brings them things. She sits in for hours and listens to them. Would you call this woman a righteous person? Certainly. Of course you would. Now, what if the manager of the old age home or the nursing home comes over to her and says, you know, I see how devoted you are to these patients. I have an offer for you. I'd like to offer to you a position here as an employee, entry level. Now you have to be here every single day at 8 o'clock in the morning, 5 days a week. You get 5 days vacation after a year. You get paid $10 an hour. You're subject to a review every 6 weeks. You have to. We have you. You're liable for any damage or any injury for the patients. Your peers will be watching you. You have to show up at all the staff meetings and the in-service trainings. After you're here a year, your vacation increases by 2 days and your salary goes up $25 a week every 6 months. And we'd like to make you this offer. Would she take the offer? Would anybody take that offer? No. Why not? Because somehow everything changes. There's a big difference between being a volunteer and being compelled to do something. There's an entirely different feeling in terms of self-satisfaction and pride. And there's a feeling when one is a volunteer that they are magnanimous and they are such a wonderful asset to the people, to the community. But one, when is employed and everybody's on their case, it's a whole different feeling. If she would agree to this offer, what would we say? There's only one logical answer if she's not self-destructive or something. The only possible reason that somebody would agree to this would be that they are so totally devoted to these patients that they know that they will do a better job if they take it, the position as an employee. That it will be for the benefit of the patients, for them to have more oversight and to be employed. When the Jewish people first said Nase, and they joined in a bris, and they said, we accept everything, and we will reveal, we will express in this world everything that you call emes, that you teach us, that is the truth, the foundation of this world. Whatever you ask from us, we will do that. And they bring a zevach, we're in a partnership, we're in a bris. Absolutely. The Jewish people reached the highest possible madrega that any human being could reach, which is total, absolute dedication, loyalty, voluntary acceptance of Hashem's will. But anyone who's sensitive must feel that for a nation to voluntarily accept God's will is a concept that can't be. It cannot be that there is a choice for humanity to accept God's will or not accept God's will. There is really no other option. There would be no world if there would not be a nation representing the will of Hashem on this world. Actually, our view is the entire world is meant to do this in unison, and that's the view for the end of days. But at least a single nation who is a light, who shows the way. Is there really an option not to accept the will of Hashem? To not receive the Torah? To not have said Nasa? Is it possible? What we're saying is in Jewish philosophy, receiving the Torah, agreeing to be the treasured nation, the nation that will always show the way, which will be Or LaGoyim, one nation at least that can salvage the purpose of the world, that knows why they're here, is not voluntary. It's not a choice, an option. It's not a possibility versus a different possibility. It is muhrach. It is absolutely necessary. The world would not exist without it. There is no such thing as the world going on without such a nation in the world. Accepting the Torah is muhrach, inevitable, absolute. There's no options. But here's the problem. How can a human make themselves bound to something involuntarily? How can a human remove that element of voluntary choice to be bound to something? Because even if the greatest thing we can do is to volunteer to receive Hashem's Torah, the fact that such a concept exists that humans chose to accept the Torah cannot stand. It must be that humans accepted and were bound to accept the Torah, because without that, there's no world at all. It's muhrach, it's absolutely embedded in the world that there should be Torah here expressed through people. So really what we're saying is that the greatest thing a person can do is volunteer to be bound to Hashem involuntarily. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu did by putting the mountain over their heads and forcing them into receiving the Torah is he elevated them to a level that they could not possibly reach on their own. They couldn't force themselves to be forced. When Hashem put the mountain over their heads, he was extending the greatest madrega that they themselves achieved. My grandfather Rav Schwab says it like this: the most the Jewish people could do is handcuff themselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and throw away the cape. Now we're stuck. Now we are bound. We're bound. When they said Naseh, Naseh v'nishma, that's what they did. We are bound. We are throwing away the cape. But there's a problem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could always release them, right? There has to be an element where Hashem himself binds them so they have no more choice. It has to be that no one can ever say, well, they chose the Torah, but had they not chose the Torah, things would have been different. There's no way that a human can say that there was an option of choosing Torah or not. So now we begin to see that yira, a certain level of yira, fear, is actually greater than love. Let's take that further. When Rambam in Hilchos Yesod HaTorah talks about love and fear, he doesn't even begin to discuss fear of punishment, yira sa'onesh. That doesn't even count. That's not the fear we're talking about. That's before love. That fear, which we normally translate serving God out of fear, we think of fear of punishment. That is so basic. It is so elementary. It is so expected of every human being that Rambam doesn't even mention it in his discussion of how a person comes to love and fear God. He's not talking about that kind of fear. In fact, Rambam says that people who are not educated, who are not trained in philosophy, who are not taught enough to love Hashem, to understand the spiritual nature of things and the mitzvahs of Hashem, should be encouraged to keep the mitzvahs out of fear of punishment until they mature enough to understand that we keep the mitzvahs for other reasons, such as, he says, people who should be taught like this are children and women. Now, in his day, women were uneducated, not just by the Jews, everywhere, that's how it was. Women were not intellectual, you know, this was not their avenue. They had no opportunity, and so it is possible, I'm sure it was in his day, that this was they knew less and they were taught on this level. It doesn't mean forever and ever that's how it is. Obviously, it's not like that today anymore. In any case, that's fear of punishment. Let's not even talk about that. Then comes Rambam says, ahava, love. A person wants to be close to Hashem. That's what we're seeing in Mishpatim here. Zavachim, a bris, the dam of the bris, half on the Mizbeach, half on the Jews. Then Rambam says, when a person is so overflowing with love of God and a desire to become close to God, all of a sudden a whole new emotion begins to overtake them, and that is awe, which we call yira also. It's not fear of punishment, it's fear of sin, right? Fear of doing anything to damage any closeness or contact we've established with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, any feeling of devekus, of clinging that a person establishes through their prayer, through their tzaras that they've gone through. Whatever we've built, we don't want to damage it. That's fear of sin. When a person fears sin, they're afraid in any way to put a blemish on the closeness they have with Hashem. That's because they're not just loving Hashem, they're so in awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they feel small and humble. As Moshe himself, who knew Hashem the best, said, you know, he couldn't imagine himself as anything. He was the most humble man on earth because he was comparing himself, obviously, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So even in this formula, yira, that type of fear, is greater than love. Certainly, we see by Matan Torah that the heart of the mountain on their head, the thunder and lightning, Hashem raised them up to a level of clarity, of the power of Hashem, the awesome power, overarching might of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem controlling all things, thunder, lightning, the shofar getting stronger, silence in the world. That experience so terrified them, physically, emotionally, and brought to them a sense of the grandeur of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that they could never forget, that we still don't forget. All these years later, we still, embedded in a Jewish soul, is still a sense of the bris and the awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if a soul is not trained and not educated to express this, they find themselves in disharmony very often, and they don't know what they're missing, why they don't feel right, something is wrong, and they might not know what it is, but they feel the pain. So this is the sequence of events. Why is Mishpatim separated from Yisroel? Why is Mishpatim separated from Yisroel? Because the two elements of receiving the Torah and being connected to Hashem out of fear and out of love are separated. Why is fear taught first? Because that's the primary bond. That is the bond of compulsion. That is not the voluntary bond. That is the bond that forces us, that is what establishes in the world that there was really no other option. And that's the truest. That is the absolute truth. The bond of love comes later. It's taught later. Happens at the same time, of course. Actually, as we said, happens first, but is taught later. Now we go to our next question. What about that medrash? One of our questions. What about the medrash that the Goyim said, no, don't kill, don't steal, not for us? What did they free themselves of? They're bound by those mitzvahs anyway. My grandfather Schwab explains that what the Jewish people received at Har Sinai were not particular laws. Most of them were long established already. What they received at Har Sinai as matan is matana, this gift that we're just talking about. This experience that embedded into the neshama of every Jew, the realization of the absolute bond we have with Hashem and the sense of being muhrach, bound inevitably, absolutely, with no options. To the extent that this is so, as we said, embedded in a Jewish soul, that when it's not taught and expressed in a person's life, great pain and disharmony results. People drown it out with things, with food and entertainment and all of that, but it is certainly lurking there. And this is the matana. David HaMelech expresses it like this. He says, Toratcha v'toch mea, your Torah is within me. It's not something outside of me, an objective truth that I do. It's something in me that I express naturally. It's like the air I exhale. It's part of me. By the way, everybody speaks about this little indentation under the nose that the Malach is teaching Torah in the womb. And then when the baby is born, he touches him here and he forgets all his Torah. What's that medrash about? Is there a Malach in the womb? The medrash is trying to say the same idea we've been speaking about. When a person learns Torah during the course of their life, because it is part of us, it's not like they're encountering something brand new that they have to acclimate, you know, emotionally and intellectually to. It's not something foreign. It's something familiar and close, something a person is returning to, not something a person is finding for the first time. When the Malach, so to speak, learns Torah with the neshama before it's born, it means that all the Torah afterwards is something familiar, something we're reuniting with, because it's natural, it's part of the way, it's in our, you can't find the physical part of the body that holds it, but the neshama holds it. It's part of our mind and the way we think and the way we feel, whether we know it or not. Some people are blessed too that it is taught and expressed to them. Some people are not given the opportunity for this to express itself. They find it later. Some people don't. But this is certainly in the core of every neshama. So this is what the nations rejected. They still are bound by the laws, but it's something outside of them. It's something they do, you might say, that they are forced to go through the motions, the actions of particular, you know, setting up courts or whatever their mitzvahs are, not killing, not stealing. But it doesn't express an inner essence, necessarily. The Jewish people are in a bris, two sides of one coin, two entities expressing the same thing. It's who we are. Now we go to our question about the slave and talking about Naseh v'Nishma. Why is Nishma greater than plain Naseh? Remember our questions about the slave? Why pierce his ear now? He stole 7 years ago. So in the Aseres Hadibros, the halacha of do not steal refers to do not stealing and do not steal a person. Do not kidnap. When this poor person stole money or sold himself into slavery because he was destitute, he's not guilty of transgressing do not steal, do not kidnap. However, every human being that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created here has a responsibility to express through their neshama that Hashem took the time out to make every face different and every neshama different for a reason. Not that Hashem has time, but obviously there is an effort put into every neshama being unique and every face being unique. Because every person plays their particular role, you've heard this many times, in expressing that eternal, that universal MS, not just as part of the nation, but as an individual. When he says that he would rather be a slave to this guy, in other words, live out his master's dreams, express his master's individuality, his master's preferences, he now is chayav and stealing from God, a human being. Stealing an neshama with its own individual potential from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Creator. Hijacking his own potential. We talked about last week that a person, there are three relationships, one being ben adam la'atmo, between man and his soul. And we talked about the possibility of a person can be chote al nafsho, sin against his own soul. This is a case of that. The first laws in Mishpatim, following the story of the giving of the Torah, are laws that teach us that it's not just the nation that had received the Torah and is in a bris with Hashem, and is bound and feels themselves bound. It is every individual. And if one single individual hijacks his own potential and attaches himself to living out someone else's dreams, he is chayav now, at this moment, of not stealing. He's transgressed the halach of not kidnapping. He has transgressed the ear that heard, do not steal, is now guilty of stealing. And the ear that heard, do not make yourself another master. I am the master. You are my slaves. Now is guilty. Because now it has nothing to do with the fact that he's destitute. Now it's a preference. When we said Nasa Venishma, we will do it and we will hear it. That is the greatest, that was part of the bris, that indicates the highest achievement of Klal Yisrael. What is Nasa and what is Nishma? And how does it relate to the individual, and how does it reverberate through the generations? Nasa, my grandfather Rav Schwab explains, Nasa v'nishma means we will do all of the actions. We will not do them like the non-Jews because they're outside of us. We will do them because they express truth, because that is who we are, because we accept everything. But in addition to that, nishma. At some point in every person's life, the Dvar Hashem comes to that person, the Hashem's message to them. With a Navi, it's real speech. With the Jewish people, for many generations, it was real messages. But we call when Hashem expects something from a person, when Hashem gives someone a challenge, when Hashem puts someone into a situation where they expect them to go beyond where they've gone to up till now, to take the next step, to release the potential that is within them. That's called the Devar Hashem. When Hashem gives somebody Yisurim, it's called the words of Hashem. That's Hashem's message to that person. Think about a fire drill. If we never prepare for a moment of crisis, then panic sets in and we don't know what to do. Same thing in a human life. When the Devar Hashem comes to a person, and I believe that no one escapes this at some point or another, even if it's their own aging, their own deterioration, a message, life has a purpose, if God forbid it's a crisis, some type of catastrophe, some type of great challenge in their life. When the Devar Hashem comes to a person, they must be prepared to know how to receive it and act on it and not go into a panic or some type of tailspin or disintegrate or fall apart. The only way to be able to receive the Devar Hashem, to hear what Hashem calls out to the person, is to prepare all their life for this moment. Nasa, we will do it so that we will be able to hear it when the time comes. We will be able to hear Hashem's message when the time comes. Now, there are thousands of explanations of Nasa v'nishma, but this one, among all of them, indicates what is different between Nasa and Nasa v'nishma. Nasa says, we will do it. We will do it. We will keep all of the mitzvahs. But beyond keeping the mitzvahs is being able to really live out our side of the bris. If two entities are both expressing the same reality, Hashem expresses the emes through, as we said, miracles and prophecies and whatever, Hashem's domain, running the world. We express it by receiving and accepting everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu meets out to us and using it as a Kiddush Hashem and using it as a way to get closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So a person prepares a whole life for that possibility, for that, when that time comes. Every individual is going to have a different relationship to Nasa v'nishma, how they do and how they prepare and how they receive when the time comes. If a person doesn't develop themselves and doesn't know themselves and their own potential, which is the sin of the Eved, he's stolen, he's kidnapped, he's now living out someone else's potential, someone else's vision, then that person will not necessarily be ready for the nishma, which is unique to every single person. How does nishma reverberate through the generations? Well, we know that Har Sinai is a bris. we've spoken about that it's two sides to one coin. But Har Sinai wasn't an event that was relegated to 3,000 years ago. Every single day we relive Har Sinai and re-accept upon ourselves our role in the bris. Every day, every individual, privately, with their eyes covered, quietly, in their own private space, audible, but it's very personal, accepts their role in the bris one more time. The Shema Yisrael that we say every day is the reiteration of the Aseres HaDibros, the first two. We say, I'm sorry, Hashem says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. We say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem Elokeinu is parallel to Anochi Hashem Elokecha. Hashem said, Lo Yielach Elohim Achirim, do not have other gods. We say, Hashem Echad. Every day when we say Shema, we reiterate our perceiving and accepting of the basic premises, our role, individually, to fulfill these truths. What is Shema? Notice that what is unique about the ear is that of all the sense organs, it is the only one that is totally receptive. The eyes see, they take in messages, images, but they also convey. You can speak with your eyes. The nose inhales, smell, exhales. The mouth, takes in, tastes, speaks. Sense of touch, you can also feel. You can convey with touch. What about your ears? It's a one-way street. It's strictly receptive. It means Shema, to hear and receive, eliminate our own agenda, our own subjective opinions, our the way we see things, the way we've been trained to see things and feel about things, eliminate everything. Make ourselves totally receptive to accept the truth that comes from Hashem without filters, without it being, manipulated into all kinds of contorted things that we hope it would be. to consider beautiful what Hashem considers beautiful, to consider ugly what God considers ugly. Each individual, personally, in shul or not in shul, says Shema every day, which continues this experience of Sinai, the individual experience of themselves hearing what Hashem himself wants from them as an individual, and preparing themselves to be able to express that all of the time. And realizing that that ultimately there really is no other option, certainly not for a Jew. There really is no other option. We might fool ourselves to think, well, God is here and I'm here. God has his will, I have my will. I can choose to receive, do what Hashem wants or not to do what Hashem wants. The whole thing is so foolish when we think about the big picture. To build in a person the sense of being bound absolutely without any options, muchrach, which leads a person to, this is what we call yira, the great sense of awe of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of their role here expressing Hashem, Hashem's will in this world. And this is the objective for every Jew all the time. When we say Shema, we're meant to have in mind Shema here completely, and have in mind the first two Dibros, and to be mekabel them one more time. But to know we're not receiving something against our will, it's a matana of something that's part and parcel of our will. It's natural to us. It's what we want to do anyway. It's where our soul drives us anyway. Sometimes we're just not lucky enough to realize that. Okay. We'll end here.